When Congolese President Laurent Kabila fell to an assassin's bullet, the fitful lens of world attention again turned to his giant and troubled country. The problems of the Congo are indeed deserving of sustained and benign world attention. Whether the global community will react constructively is yet to be seen. But if there is to be effective action, it must first be grounded in a firm understanding of a challenging phenomenon of our emerging 21st century. Collapsed states, and then we must seek ways of preventing such collapse. My guest is William Zartman, professor and director of African Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Bill, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's very good to have you here, and boy, what a timely topic you bring to our attention. We're going to concentrate, Bill, you and I, largely on the Congo and problems of states verging on collapse in Africa, but I have a sense that your work on this whole notion of collapsed states is a worldwide issue. It's not solely limited to Africa. Am I right in that?
Absolutely. Collapse is something that can happen in lots of other places, and we have other examples. Haiti is an example. Yugoslavia as a single state collapsed, although the pieces were rapidly picked up. And there are other cases of near collapse in other parts of the world. But Africa brings us the largest number.
It does indeed. I'm glad you used that phrase, because I have before me a summary, I guess, well, it's a graphic depiction of a study done by the Center for International Development and Conflict Management at the University of Maryland, which shows an awful lot of destabilizing states in Africa, indeed, a vast number of states in trouble. But in that context, in talking about Africa, Bill, I think you've also pointed out in your writings that we have to moderate our approach to this and give African states, sub-Saharan African states in particular, I suppose, substantial credit for muddling through. They've had kind of a difficult challenge to face, have they not, in sort of becoming viable?
Yeah, the other side of the realization that collapse is not just African, but happens in other areas, is the realization that lots of African states have made it. We have, I don't know, half a dozen or so of states that one could say are in the process or have arrived at collapse in Africa, but there are half a hundred states in Africa, and a number of them have, starting at the very beginning, put together their state structures and given their people an institutionalized framework for continuing their existence.
I think that's, Bill, that has the advantage of both being true and hopeful. And I think both attributes are important as I guess we both hope world attention and the attention of our State Department in particular turn toward Africa, that there are success stories there.
Yeah. The other thing I think to remember about collapse is that it's not just a condition where you either are or aren't, but it's a process. It's a process that I like to liken to one of those movies where the car is falling off the cliff and it falls, it looks like, ever so slowly, and then it hits a ledge, and then it teeters for a while. And then, in this particular movie, it falls down again and hits another ledge and so on in this slow process, but with a number of spots where one teeters. And African states or states in general go through that process. They may fall off the first ledge, and many of them will bounce back. But a couple others will go down. And so it's that stepped process that I think it's important to look at and to understand.
Well, may I say, Bill, by way of observation, your writings have a marvelous ability for the very colorful depiction that helps the lay reader understand. And you bring us precisely to a very important point early in our conversation. What precisely do we mean by a collapsed state? Now, you've just told us it's a process that leads somewhere. But when a state is collapsed, barring absolute anarchy and chaos, which I think we can all understand, what are its qualities? What are its conditions? What is a collapsed state?
Well, first of all, what it's not is that it's not often absolute anarchy and chaos. That is, people on the local level tend to organize themselves in little pieces, although the general framework, the national framework, has gone. And that's what collapsed states is. It's the breakdown of legitimate authority, law, and order, so that there is no institution. It's deinstitutionalization. There's no institution to represent and perform the functions of the central government.
Would you say, Bill, it's a massive performance failure in part of the
Sure, government. It's a performance failure, and that brings up another point. I use the word collapse. I wish that were that's used sometimes, but not always. And sometimes people talk about failed states, but I don't like the idea of failed states because that's because states can fail in lots of things, but they can still keep their institutional structure. They can fail in meeting some task or other.
Bill Zartman, I'm sure you'd agree that the very best thing we could do, we world society, is to prevent collapse in the first place. Second best, of course, would be to have remedies for states that fall into that condition, and you've written on both things. But fundamental to all of that, and to both of those questions, is the I guess the starting one is, why do states fall into states of collapse? I mean, is there one given pattern, or are there a variety of themes on this particular
Well, they fall, to use a kind of banal and general statement, they fall into this pattern because they're unable to perform the functions that are required of a state. But the cause behind that can be, it can be several. They can run out of resources. They can run out of skills and ideas. And I think it's important to recognize that as well, because we often think that collapse and conflict come simply from poverty, and that is a lack of resources, not only the people, but of the state. But even in poor conditions, people with ideas, with organization and so on can make do with their populations. Much more important is running out of ideas. I was slipping into ideals as well, and I'll come back to that because it's important, skills and so on. What we find in Africa is that a great contributor to the cause of collapse is simply people who've got the wrong idea of government. They think that the state is something, again to use the term, something that they can privatize themselves, and where they can take hold of the resources and use them for their own good.
Are there historic reasons for that, or why do they think that? Why would that be a particularly African way, perhaps, of falling into collapse?
I'm not sure it's particularly African, again, but it's related to the process of setting up new governments when independence has just arrived. And so an interesting comparison always to make is between Africa now and Latin America a century ago. Also, it has to do with established ideas of governance. And there one has less of a case of a state collapse perhaps in Asia because the state was an older construction than it was in Latin America in the 19th century or in Africa in the past, in the 20th century. More positively, they do this because they've got the wrong understanding of what self-determination involves when the coming of independence.
Let's focus on that. I think it's a very rich point. Let's apply it to the Congo, because I believe you're written in 1960, 61, 62, the point 61, 62, I suppose, the point at which Congo was going through this process. There was, and Duke, stop me if I got this one wrong, because I think it's essential here, sort of a very strong or almost absolute lack of confidence between the key institutions of government. That army distrusted judiciary, distrusted the administration. I mean, the various departments were themselves in conflict right from that point.
They were in conflict, and they were underdeveloped, enormously underdeveloped. The country wasn't prepared to exercise its self-determination. Congo is a special case as well as a typical case, because its nationalist movement really arose very late, whereas in lots of other countries, the nationalist movement had a chance to arise. But when independence came, it meant independence from foreign rule. That is, self-determination means that somebody else doesn't rule us.
Right.
But it then allowed people to take hold of that idea and say, well, I will rule us in your name or in our name, but I'll do it all by myself. Mm-hmm. And so the link between the ruler and the ruled was broken, and the ruler then said, after all, this money is all lying around. Why can't it be for me, since I represent the nation? And that's the case of Mobutu.
So that is, now this then is a precise idea of starting with the wrong ideas.
That's right.
That's very clear.
Or starting with the wrong ideas by twisting the right idea, stopping it short, having a truncated process of self-determination, and using it for one's own purposes.
Staying with perhaps the Congo as an example, or using others, What happens when that happens, Bill? Do we get a kind of a vicious cycle, so to speak? And if so, how would you describe it?
Well, two main tracks of describing what happens. Frequently, what has happened in the Congo is not exactly a case as clear as some others, but still might fit to an extent. Is that then the government which brought independence is pushed out because it has no way of renewing itself. Elections aren't legitimate because George Washington is in power, and George Washington decides not to leave instead of the real George Washington. So the army comes in. And it may fix some of the problem, but it more and more it narrows its base until it's only responsible to a small group of people, and that's very much what happened in Congo and in lots of other countries as well. And it also ties in. Iraq is not a collapsed state, but it's a state that's certainly on the process because power has been so concentrated and privatized in the small group's hands.
As that power gets concentrated and privatized in that small group's hands, does repression become more and more the way they maintain themselves, and that, of course, breeds discontent? And
that's right.
Here we go.
Repression goes, so people complain about that. Repression goes on. The group is narrowed more and more. And we have a case such as we had in Liberia. It's a good example where the ruler, Sergeant Doe, ended up representing himself and a couple, a small ethnic group, a couple cronies, and everybody else was alienated.
When states get into that situation of collapse, and I do appreciate that last point. I think it's vital. They have states that have a great deal of difficulty getting out of it once they're in it. I mean, there's a, to use an aviation phrase, a point of no return almost, where you can't regenerate so easily. When they get in that situation, Bill, and here's maybe my own colorful take on it, I tend to think of the danger they represent as transcending their borders and potentially affecting their regions, that they become perhaps something of a sinkhole. I mean, if you have a collapsed state like Congo, where you've got five armies, I think, at the moment engaged in there, the problem becomes more than their problem at that point. Is that not the real cost, I mean, to the international
community? Yeah, you said sinkhole. That's a good image. I use the word vacuum as well. Nature abhors a vacuum in politics as well as in other things. And so this empty hole in the middle draws in countries from the outside. Obviously, decisions are made to come in. But whether decisions were made, decisions aren't made on a tabula rasa, and they are made because they are the countries on the outside are pulled in to fill that vacuum. Had there been a state in Congo, the countries around it, and particularly Rwanda and Angola, who have legitimate security concerns, would have gone to the head of state and said, look, I've got subversive movements who are seeking sanctuary on your borders. Get rid of them. Push them back so that I can handle them. But there's nobody there in Congo effectively in power to do that.
Exactly. We're going to continue to focus on Congo and also turn our conversation in the direction of what can cure these situations in Congo and elsewhere, and perhaps most hopefully prevent them from starting in the first place. Let me take a moment from our conversation, though, Bill, to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is William Zartman, Professor and Director of African Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Bill, continuing on with this fascinating and extremely important subject of collapsed states, let's talk a bit about how they can be cured, how they can be helped. Now, you list a number of principles your various writings on this, and almost first among them is obviously trying to do something about the power structure, either restoring it, that is to say, bringing the contending parties, or often are contending parties, back into power with some sort of, one would hope, common devotion to national purpose, or elevating new rulers to take over from them. I guess two things here. First of all, comment on the relative difficulties of both those approaches, or promise of them. And then secondly, and very intriguingly to me, who would convene that? I mean, who can make that kind of thing happen?
Okay, the first thing I think to underline in this idea of, in the importance of this idea of collapsed states, is that it's not simply a matter of parachuting in a new ruler. It's not simply a matter of holding an election or something like that. What is gone are the institutions which allow this to take place. And so there has to be an institutional rebuilding and a rebuilding of people's sense of civic belonging, because the collapsing process has left the population highly alienated. So we're looking at a long-term job, and that is extremely important when we're looking at foreign policy from the outside, because we tend as Americans to roll up our sleeves, set it right, and go out. That's been the pattern of our take on world affairs for a long time. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. If these are areas that are important to us, and as the last remaining superpower they are, we have to have a staying power of our own to stay in. We need an exit strategy. Perhaps that's the buzzword of the moment, but it should allow us to be engaged for a decent amount of time. Second of all, the emphasis on collapsed states reminds us that what we need to do is rebuild the state. If you just go in and hold elections, they're for what? In what framework? And if you elect somebody but without having a set of institutions to carry out his policies and to help focus the attention of the population, you've just elected him to stand on a pedestal all by himself, but without any ability to carry forth the policies that are necessary.
So providing resources and to back
That's
them
right.
up and.
Yeah. So this means then that we have to remember that exactly providing resources, the phrase that we've used, if the person is elected to power, he has to be able to reward followers, to draw people in, to carry out programs. And so almost on a bet, that is, we can't expect results by Monday. Mm-hmm. Outside powers, outside institutions have to help in this process. You also mentioned bringing back parties into the state building process. What is needed in cases like this at some point is to call a conference to bring back the various forces that exist and help them come together and build a national tissue.
Sort of a national convention sort of thing?
That's right. That's right. And this is something that's been done in many cases all over the world. There are a number of conferences that were attempted of the various forces in Liberia, in Lebanon, that finally produced an agreement, in Somalia, that didn't produce an agreement over the past decade, mm-hmm. because for the most part, if there were one single reason to look at, it's that the convening parties didn't have the patience to let these Somalis, who are great talkers, sit down and talk out their problems in a conference of a month or two long.
I've been intrigued throughout our conversation. Where would you place Congo on the scale of collapse we were talking about, the progression? Is it in collapse right now?
No, it's down there at the bottom. It's down there at the bottom. The Mobutu was used to be called mayor of Kinshasa and Gbadalite, because the Gbadalite was his traditional home and palace. Kabila Papa, you could only call mayor of Kinshasa, and he doesn't even hold half of his country, because Mobutu had pretensions of holding the rest of his country, but Kabila and Kabila's son is faced with a rebellion that has control of half of the country.
So Congo's in the emergency ward.
In the emergency ward, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it so hard for it to bounce back.
In trying to bounce back, at some point, elections are going to be, new round of elections are going to be very important. You've given us the Council of Patience. Americans, of course, are extremely interested in elections. It's something that we strive to. To promote around the world. But what do you say, Bill Zartman, about the not just the place, but the timing of elections in situations like this? Is it, first of all, how important is it to the process of restoration? And with what approach should outside groups take up this subject? I mean, advocating it right away, trying to build structures before the elections take place, or what do you do?
Soon, but not too soon. Calling elections now, of course, nobody's talking about that, but elections immediately would be just an empty exercise. Elections, however, were being planned over the past decade. First of all, under that extraordinary experiment of Congo, the Sovereign National Conference, where the people tried to take sovereignty into their own hands and did with a 2,000-member conference convention in the early 90s, mm-hmm. wrote a constitution and so on, and in the end, unfortunately, were outfoxed by Mobutu. Mm-hmm. But during, in the mid-90s, preparations were going ahead to four elections, stopped in part by the fact that we all realized that the best organized candidate was Mobutu, and he would have won, and that's not the transition that was that one was looking for. Then Kabila came in, Kabila father came in, and now there's a lot of road to rerun in order to get to elections. What's important first, everybody's aware of it, is that what is called the dialogue provided for in the Lusaka agreements of 1999 be started honestly, in which all the parties of the country, including the government as one of the parties, and also the rebel parties and also the nonviolent opposition, rapidly get into a meeting together, this convention that we talked about, and decide on the rules of the game and then the procedures that would be carried out.
We're talking about curing collapsed states, Bill Zartman, but clearly the most hopeful path, and I'm sure you would agree, is prevention in the first place, mm-hmm. keeping this from happening. And in that regard, much can be said, and you have indeed said much on this. But let me ask you one question on this in terms of the outside community, the world at large. In terms of preventing states from collapsing in the first place, how meaningful or important are international conventions or standards or things like, for example, I'm thinking very specifically of Helsinki, which did so much in the case of Europe, where you get human rights as mm-hmm. something you should aspire to. Does that resonate? And if so, does that have an effect on keeping this from happening?
You bet it does. And I'm glad you mentioned Helsinki, because I think one of the great events in the post-war world was the formulation, the organization of a Helsinki for Africa, by a man who was out of the job other than chicken farming at the time that he got this idea, but one of the great Democrats of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, in 1991, who pulled together civil society groups and drew up a Kampala document, as it's called, and called for a conference on stability, security, development, and cooperation in Africa by the unwieldy title of CSSDCA, which is hard to memorize. Mm-hmm. And the document that he produced, the Kampala document, is an extraordinary statement of principles, goals, a new regime for African states now, specifically African, written by Africans, in addition, for African states coming out of this condition I described earlier, where one had a truncated process of self-government and where the people are still thirsty for the answers, the completion of the process of self-determination, of taking care of their own destiny according to appropriate rules. It's an African version of the Helsinki process. And it was stopped for a while, and now it has been endorsed by the OAU, the Organization of African Unity. And the process is going again, now that Obasanjo is president of Nigeria, to put this, to call this conference and then have the principles adopt. Mm-hmm. Holding up principles is extremely important. We don't know how to behave if we write our own rules at the moment. And principles are not self-enforcing, and the world is not has no enforcement mechanism. We know that. There's no world government. But simply the brandishing of principles and then the reminding of principles is an extremely important matter.
Extremely important indeed, Bill, and eloquently stated by you. I'm sure Václav Havel and others would be in absolute agreement with you mm-hmm. on that point.
Right.
It's encouraging to know from you right now that there is this document now, African produced.
That's right.
And therefore African relevant.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bill, it's, as I expected, it had been an enormous pleasure having this conversation with you. And I want to conclude it by bringing it right home to our shores and in particular our town, to Washington. We mentioned earlier this extraordinary moment of, it's not unusual. Our administrations change here happily, very peacefully, but we have a new one in town. And the country we've most cited in our conversation, Congo, of course, mm-hmm. has its new leadership as well. In terms of the U.S., Bill, you have written critically about our, not just our actions, but our failure to act, I suppose, is better mm-hmm. better said.
Right.
I would almost call it the sin of inaction in terms of Rwanda, specifically in Africa, and even at earlier stages of the Congolese descent. because I think this question of timing is very much a part of your writing. There are specific points at which things can be helpfully done. With that in mind, and with this moment, and it is indeed an extraordinary moment when you can say something at the outset of new thinkers, new actors on the stage in the United States and in Africa. How should the U.S. now approach the question of collapsed states generally, and specifically the question of states in Africa on verge of collapse or in collapse?
A couple ideas, very general ones, because that's what guides the specific. First of all, we should be aware of the problem. We should not be looking at the 170 so states around the world as if they are all Weberian states in a perfect form of development, and we can just deal them on the basis of international relations. There should be a preventive attention and institutions of preventive attention within the State Department, within the U.S. government, looking ahead. Our reflex so often now when somebody comes in and says something's on the horizon, the reflex is a bureaucratic one of don't bother me, can't you see I'm putting out fires. Mm-hmm. We need to see smoke before the flames burst out. Second, I've said we need to be engaged in situations that are important to us in a country the size of Congo with a location of Congo. Location, 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 as we say, can only be important to us within the African continent. And then we need to, as well, third, talk with our allies, with other countries that have interests in Africa. Africa is at the bottom of the pile, the fact is, of the continents as far as interests are concerned, which doesn't mean we don't have interests in Africa, but it means that their interests are not as compelling as they are in other areas or as they are for other countries, particularly countries in Europe. In the past, over this past decade, we have neglected our cooperation and contacts, our consultation with, for example, France and other countries in regard to Africa, and we need to take that up fast so that we can establish a basis of understanding rather than simply misunderstanding across the ocean between ourselves.
As I would have expected, Bill Zartman, that's very, very good counsel. Thank you for giving it to us, and quite frankly, I hope to have you back here soon and often as we try to do our part here in keeping a kind of watch on Africa.
I look forward to it.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was William Zartman, professor and director of African Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies, Johns Hopkins University. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Rachel Edmonds. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's radiodial@aol.com.